It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Sean Munson. Some monkeys who have spent their lives in research labs may now have a chance to retire in Wisconsin. We talk with the founder of Primates Incorporated, Wisconsin's only monkey retirement sanctuary, and one of nine in the United States, about the benefits of retiring lab animals and the unique challenges they face. What questions do you have about the treatment of lab animals? Did you know retirement was even an option for them? And do you think this is something we should be prioritizing? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Kerwin is the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. Amy, good morning. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on today.
So we don't hear about monkey retirement very often. Where are these, or what are these monkeys retiring from?
Well, there's approximately 110,000 monkeys living in labs nationwide, and a lot of them are at universities and also contract testing firms. So they're tested on for the private industry and also federal grants for a variety of reasons because they are so close to us genetically.
Mm-hmm. So what reasons would there be to retire a monkey?
Well, I used to work in a laboratory with 97 rhesus monkeys, and they're actually, like I mentioned, really quite similar to us. And as a researcher or animal care staff, you tend to grow close to them. And so when the study concludes, they're not always terminal studies, and the monkeys aren't always reused. So instead of euthanizing them, more and more researchers are wanting to give back by sending them to a sanctuary whenever possible.
How long, what's the life expectancy of a rhesus monkey? How long do they normally live?
They can live to 35, 40 years old in captivity, and so there's continuation studies where the monkey is reused until their adulthood, or there's acute studies where they're used just for a few years and then sold to another study. So at Primates Incorporated, we just say when the opportunity exists, the very least we can do is be giving back to these monkeys when possible.
So if a lab doesn't choose to retire their research animals or sell them to another research project, what other options are there? And is there agreement in the industry about what should happen?
Well, the lab could choose to put them down because they have to pay a daily per diem for the monkey, or they could choose to, like I said, resell them. But if that's not the case, they could keep them on as actually breeders. So there's really not much of a motivation to retire because sanctuaries are actually asking for funding because caring for monkeys is very costly with the professional care. And so because there is disagreement amongst laboratories, the lab I worked in didn't believe in retiring the monkeys. But what I learned from networking with other laboratories was some labs had protocols in place to retire. And then I heard of primate sanctuaries actually turning away these labs wanting to retire because the sanctuaries were near capacity and couldn't do that. And that was 15 years ago. And so while locally labs were saying, there's no need for a monkey sanctuary, we reuse our monkeys or all our studies are terminal, there were actually a great need to retire the monkeys nationwide. And when I saw rejection happening, that made me resign from my laboratory and work with other laboratories who were already retiring monkeys. And then I decided to go to business school instead of my aspirations of veterinary school so that I could form a flatly run nonprofit organization that would involve the community in giving back to these monkeys because the issue is far bigger than myself.
So that's what motivated you to open Wisconsin's first monkey retirement sanctuary then. How long has the sanctuary been operating?
Well, we became a nonprofit in 2004, actually. I mean, you know, a very long time ago, but after many years of outreach, networking, involving volunteers and fundraising, we finally broke ground in 2016 to where we got our building built, and we were able to take in three monkeys of January 25th of 2018 this year, and then we were able to accommodate two more monkeys in May. And then we've now just recently created a waiting list. Now we were talking about laboratory monkeys, but there is the pet industry, and a lot of people buy pet monkeys and then they wind up sending them to sanctuaries because they're too much to handle. And how that relates is they leave less room at sanctuaries for the research monkeys. And so we've actually created a waiting list to accommodate two pet monkeys this year. And I've had to turn away 18 monkeys because we're still completing our facility and we need to expand to accommodate the demand.
We're talking with Amy Kerwin, the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. Wondering what you think about this. What questions do you have about how lab animals are treated? Did you know that retirement was even an option for these lab monkeys? Do you think this is something we should be prioritizing? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. These monkeys were born in captivity for the purpose of testing. How does that impact their behaviors and personalities?
Well, the minimum guidelines for a rhesus monkey is 4.3 square feet by 2.5 feet high. And they're typically group housed after 6 months after they're weaned from their mother. And then they're put into groups and then they're put into pairs. So there is an attempt to socialize them and give them enrichment while they are in their minimum guidelines. But I always felt as a researcher that these minimum guidelines are inadequate for these intelligent beings. And so, of course, there is some abnormal behavior, pacing, finger biting, back flipping to be able to adjust to the inadequate environment. And now, like I said, researchers care about their animals, and so they provide them with enrichment and feed once or twice a day. So there's minimum accommodations. But then what we've seen after they arrive to the sanctuary, given space, enrichment, we have a primatologist assessing behavior. We've really seen a trend, a decrease in abnormal behavior, which is what we want, by providing the socialization, foraging opportunities. And then we have innovative greenhouse environments that they'll be able to travel to in the wintertime. And what I'm really excited about is that we can analyze the behavior. And what we did was we looked up the way rhesus monkeys live in India and we studied their wild profile. And so to be able to effectively evaluate the rehabilitation, we start with their behavior at the sanctuary, and then we look at it over time and adapt it to how they would live in the wild.
We're talking with Amy Kerwin, founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. We will continue our conversation on this topic. I'm John Munson. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're learning how lab monkeys can retire to a sanctuary in Wisconsin from Amy Kerwin, the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. Do you think we should be testing on animals for medical research? How do you think we should balance the animal's quality of life with our need for research. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Amy Kerwin is the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys, and she is with us this morning. So what impact does retiring lab animals have on the human researchers?
Well, it's the ultimate ethical compromise in my mind. It allows them to give back to the monkeys afterwards, and they do grow close to them. So each time I speak with a researcher, I ask them, you know, did it improve your morale? And do you think it would improve employee retention? And they say yes every time. So I do this by case by case by interview, because there's not much in the literature about it. But it can be discouraged in the lab as well. So that can be frustrating, especially if they label primate retirement as this animal rights labeling to divide us, when if it's happening in other labs, animal rights labeling shouldn't have anything to do with it.
So the sanctuary facility was constructed for the purpose of retiring lab monkeys. When you were designing the structures, what factors did you take into account?
Well, I toured the various sanctuaries around the U.S., as many as I could, and other volunteers for us toured the other ones. And what we did was we took notes on all the great things they were doing. And what I learned a long time ago is there's more than one correct way to do something. And so what we did was we took the top aspects from every facility, and we wanted to establish here in Wisconsin, because there is such a need for primate retirement that I believe there should be a monkey sanctuary built in every state. It doesn't matter the climate. You can build them with greenhouses. You can build it spaciously. There's two sanctuaries in Canada. There's one in Washington. And so what we did was we worked with growing domes, growing spaces, and we built these two geodesic domes that will have vegetation during the winter time. And we're still working on completion, but they will have walkways to the indoor housing. And then these monkeys will be able to travel between two enclosures over the winter. And then in the summer, they have the outdoor enclosures, so they'll be able to have three enclosures to travel between. So we're excited about that.
Amy Kerwin is the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. We're talking about this project this morning on The Morning Show. Talk about the benefits of having a facility that mimics natural habitat for the animals.
Yes, well, it's amazing to see, like I mentioned, their abnormal behaviors decreasing and then the foraging increasing. And kind of the nice thing about our analyzing everything is what we learned in the morning while we're preparing produce for the monkeys, they get anxious. And what I saw at the lab too, when we brought food in the room, was one monkey would bite his finger in anticipation. It really reminded me of a human, like excited to eat and come on, let's get eating here. So what we noticed was River was pacing when he was waiting for food, walking in circles, and then Mars would get upset and bite his arm, actually, which is a very disturbing abnormal behavior to see, but he doesn't break the skin. At any rate, that was out of anxiety for wanting to eat. And so what we did was, as soon as we get there in the morning, we scatter out bird seed and dried banana chips, nuts, throughout their enclosures and in front of them, so they're happily foraging while we prep their produce, and so we don't see any abnormal behavior in the morning. And so we will be writing about that and many other things, and sharing with the public, involving people at our sanctuary for volunteering in primate behavior and primate care.
So tell us again, how many monkeys are retired at Primates Incorporated right now?
We have five total right now, with two on a waiting list.
And when you complete your facility, what's the capacity going to be? How many monkeys will you be able to accommodate once you get everything done?
Well, it depends on the ones coming in, if they're social housed or not. What I'm excited about also is our primatologists assessed behavior this summer, and we were able to pair River with Batman and Timon, who arrived. So that created a trio and opened up a space for us to create our waiting list for these two. So this first indoor-outdoor complex that we have costs $300,000, and it can only house up to 20 monkeys, yes. But we will build four more complexes over the next 10 years. So that we can help up to 100 monkeys. And we're willing to share our knowledge and expertise with anyone who wants to set up a primate sanctuary so that one can be set up in any state so no monkeys ever turned away from retirement ever again.
How is a retirement sanctuary different from a zoo or other examples of animals in captivity?
Well, I had actually tried to collaborate with the zoos or ask some questions years ago because I felt like they had the funding to maybe help the monkeys from research. But like I said, the monkeys come with abnormal behavior, and honestly, no zoo's going to want to show for plucking rhesus to the public. But that doesn't matter. I mean, the point is they deserve rehabilitation, and then they deserve peace and quiet, and deserve what they want to do what they want to do. And so we basically have a strict routine for them so they're not surprised, except the one surprises they like are getting enrichment and tearing open the bag to see what's inside. But really, we try to keep their surprises limited. And then so when we allow visitors in the spring, we're only going to allow up to 10 people a week to visit. So we'll be done with our facility by then. But that will be, you know, to share knowledge, for transparency, to show respect to the animals. And then we always have our ongoing volunteer opportunities where you can volunteer on the land at the sanctuary and then help me in fundraising too. That's my primary role. And we have a professional staff of 5 people up there at the sanctuary ready to train anyone who wants to learn. So
you've used the term enrichment a few times. What does that mean in this context?
Yes, we've got an enrichment schedule, actually, where the monkeys get something different every day, and they also always get scatter forage in the morning. They get foraging tubs, which is wood chips and then a trail mix, forage and dried fruit, and then they pick through that all day, which is a great form. Then we have frozen fruit. Actually, you can throw big pieces of fruit on top of their enclosure. And in the morning, they get a natural diet of their produce and some monkey chow, which is fortified. That's what they get in the lab. But we have a 50-50 diet, so they get 50% monkey chow, 50% produce. And then they get enrichment in the morning, enrichment in the afternoon, and then in the p.m. they get a giant salad with some fruit and more of their monkey chow. So they are always satisfied, have something to do. Even resting is a great behavior because it's not abnormal behavior. They do spend some of their time, you know, resting and laying down, and it's great to see them relaxing. Mars, he's a singly housed monkey, and we provide him with extra enrichment until he finds his future mate. He's a dominant male monkey. But he likes to be groomed, so how the staff safely grooms him when he comes up front, we have a back scratcher that we can put through the enclosure and scratch him, and he lays down and presents for us to groom him. And so that's really part of it, is giving the monkeys what they want. If they want to be groomed, they can. If they want to rest and be away from you, they can. They have mirrors that they watch us all what we're doing. It's really great to see.
So where can listeners go if they are interested in learning more about your organization and how they can support it, if that's what they would like to do?
Well, our website is Primates Inc., primatesinc.com. And so you can sign up on our email list and view our sponsor monkey program, sponsor building program. It would be great to have your listeners involved in helping us because this is a great community effort, like I said.
And there are only 9 of these facilities in the country. What do we have to do to get more of them built, do you think?
There needs to be a team effort among laboratories to get funds established so that they can be provided when a researcher wants to retire their monkeys. It had been denied by funding institutions as non-essential funding sometimes. And so if laboratories could start to agree on retiring their monkeys and addressing this issue, that would be great.
Okay, Amy, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Amy Kerwin is the founder and executive director of Primates Incorporated, a retirement sanctuary for former lab monkeys. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. Illegal wildlife trade is in high demand, and the consequences include irrevocable extinctions. You might think that things like bear bile, tiger meat, and pangolin scales might not be the hottest commodities on the market, but at somewhere between $7 and $23 billion, the market for products derived from endangered species is right up there with illicit drugs and arms trades. Consequences are rampant and irrevocable extinctions. We talk with Rachel Love Neuer about her new book covering all that and more. The book is titled Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. Why do you think trade of endangered animals continues in spite of laws against it? Let us know. 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Rachel Love Neuer, welcome to The Morning Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Delighted to be here.
So before you were a journalist, you were a conservation ecologist. Where was the point in your career as an ecologist when you realized that just how widespread the illegal wildlife trade actually is?
Well, to clarify, I was an aspiring conservation ecologist. I was a master's in ecology in rural Vietnam, and while I was down there, I heard about Vietnam's last Javan rhino being killed for its horn, and this really piqued my interest. I was like, why was this animal killed? How is it found? Where is that horn going? All these questions just popped up in my mind.
When you tell the average person on the street that there is an illegal bear bile trade or an illegal tiger meat trade, one might assume that it's a small, you know, super niche market. But that's not actually the case, right? I mean, what's the scope of the illegal wildlife trade?
It depends on which facet of the trade you are talking about. But even something niche like tiger meat, if applied across over a billion people in China, is not so niche. And this trade is affecting thousands of species, millions of individuals. It's absolutely massive.
Compare it to something other big illegal contraband markets like drug trafficking, human trafficking, arms dealing, that kind of thing.
Yes, it is third or fourth in terms of contraband markets in the world and profitability.
We need to let that sink in because that's a really big, a much bigger deal, I think, than anybody would average person would think when they hear about this. How much of species decline and extinction is driven by illegal trafficking in 2018? Is this as big a factor as climate change, for example?
It is a very large factor. One of the big issues in tackling this trade is that we don't know how big of a factor it is because the data just aren't there. So you mentioned pangolins, for example. Over the last 10 years, over 1 million pangolins have been killed for illegal wildlife trade. But we don't know how many are left in the wild. So they could be on the brink of extinction. We don't know.
In your book, you talk about pangolins as the most trafficked mammal in the world. They've been described as an artichoke with legs. I admit I had to Google it. I'd never heard of a pangolin before. Tell us about these mammals and what is it about them that makes them so sought after?
Yes, pangolins are now my new favorite animal. Everybody should look them up. They're amazing creatures. Nocturnal, the world's only scaly mammal. They live in Asia and Africa. Unfortunately, these shy little creatures are highly sought after for traditional Chinese medicine. Their scales are thought to produce effects such as stimulating breast milk production in ladies who aren't lactating. In places like Vietnam, their meat is also highly sought after. If you're a wealthy businessman and you want to impress some colleagues, you take them out for a meal of pangolin and they're going to be blown away.
So, obviously, this business is not legal. These are, I understand, these are protected animals. Why is it that this business is booming? Is this just about greed? Is it just about money?
Yeah, totally. I mean, the same reason a lot of other illegal markets are booming. Unfortunately, with wildlife trade, as you touched on earlier in the interview, people just don't know its scope. They don't care. There's a very big lack of awareness. So if you go to Vietnam, for example, even though it's completely illegal to order pangolin or bear or something like that at a restaurant, you can very, very easily find it openly for sale.
You met a Vietnamese poacher who was particularly successful with pangolins. Tell us about him, why he became a poacher and his attitude toward the trade.
Yes. So this guy, his name is Tom Ho, and I met him down in Vietnam's deep south in a place called U Minh, which is a really boggy, peaty place, not very hospitable for people. It also was bombed very, very heavily during the Vietnam War. So Tom Ho arrived in U Minh as a farmer, and things were going well, but then his son was born, and his son had a brain defect. So Tom Ho says he got into hunting to pay for his son's hospital bills. However, I visited Tom Ho a few years after the first time I met him. His son was healthy. Tom Ho was still hunting because he liked the money. I mean, you can make half a year's salary by catching a single pangolin.
The average salary is what, about $1,000 a year, and a pangolin
or less,
a pangolin would be worth what, $500?
Yeah, you're talking $300 to $500 for a single animal.
Wow. So is Tom Ho's cavalier attitude about breaking the law and law enforcement's indifference to this kind of thing typical?
Oh, for sure. I mean, during my first interview with Tom Ho, we were sitting in his house and a policeman came in to watch TV and see what was going on. And he's explaining how he catches these rare, endangered, protected animals right in front of this guy.
And the policeman didn't bat an eye?
Not at all.
So is there a lot of bribery that is involved here? Well, let's talk about that first, and then I want to follow up on that.
For sure. At the higher levels, absolutely. Bribery greases the wheels of this operation. That can be from paying off a park ranger to take his guards the other way when you're trying to kill a rhino in the field, to paying the person at customs to get your ivory through. All along the chain, there's bribery.
And in addition to bribery, you point out examples in a lot of places where the people who are actually paid to protect these animals are the ones poaching them. So we're also dealing with that as well.
Yes, corruption is one of the biggest forces acting against our ability to get a handle on illegal wildlife trade. If you have rangers in the field protecting animals who are compromised, you're never going to get a handle on that situation.
And you tell a story in your book about being offered rhino horn in Vietnam. Share that with us.
This was one of the most surreal things that happened to me on this reporting project. A Vietnamese journalist who I'm friends with offered to introduce me to one of his sources, who was a Vietnamese rhino horn user. We met at a busy, trendy restaurant in Hanoi, and this guy brings a tin of Oreos, or what I thought was Oreos, and hands it to me at the restaurant. I open it, and inside, instead of Oreos, is a piece of rhino horn, and I was like, oh my gosh. So I quickly tucked it away. But then as the meal came to a close, the rhino horn user just broke out this rhino horn in front of the waitress, in front of other patrons, and is demonstrating to me how to grind it up into a powder so he could take shots of it later to supposedly prevent a hangover. So just this blasé attitude was all throughout the trade that I witnessed.
I mean, I guess I'm trying to compare this to something that people might recognize. So you're in a restaurant in downtown Madison, and you suddenly put a line of Coke down and snort it right in front of all the patrons.
Exactly. Unbelievable, right? It's hard for us to conceive of.
It's really crazy. Illegal wildlife trafficking is a global problem, but there are some huge cultural differences at play where animal welfare and conservation are concerned. Can you delve into that for about a minute?
I mean, for sure. Definitely there's a rich cultural tradition in China and other places of using wildlife products. So ivory has always been very highly valued in China for its beauty. Rhino horn is considered a cure for breaking fevers. But on the other hand, there are these newfangled uses for wildlife products that are driving extinction. So rhino horn in Vietnam, as I mentioned earlier, has become a popular hangover cure. A lot of the people who use it for that purpose don't actually think it works, which is unbelievable. They just bring it out to show off in front of their friends and say it does that thing.
Mm. So how do you overcome these cultural differences?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question. There are groups trying to work on anti-demand campaigns in Asia, because until the demand is stopped, there's going to be trade. People will find a way to make money off of it. But messages, heartwarming messages about cuddly animals and extinctions and these things are not going to resonate with users over there, because the regard for wildlife is not what it is here. I asked that rhino horn user, for example, if he would care if rhinos go extinct, and he just said, no, why would I care about that? So we need to find another way to reach people and convince them. A lot of experts think that might be fear campaigning. For example, like the campaigns we use here about drunk driving. If you drive drunk, you will kill a child. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. This is really amazing. The other thing that was amazing to me as I was reading your book is that the United States is actually the second largest market behind China for a lot of this contraband. And I want to get into that when we come back here. That's something we'll discuss coming up with Rachel Love Neuer, a freelance science journalist who covers the environment and wildlife. She's the author of Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. If you have a question for Rachel, give us a call, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org is the email address, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. It is The Morning Show. I'm John Munson. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay tuned. Ideas Network, I'm John Munson. Poaching is a multi-billion dollar business around the world. We're learning about how it works and its effects from Rachel Love Neuer, freelance science journalist who covers the environment and wildlife. She's the author of Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. When you think about the future of endangered species, what worries you the most? What gives you the most hope? 800-642-1234, ideas at WPR.org, or tweet us at WPR Mornings. You reveal in your book that the United States, after China, is the second largest market for this contraband. I guess that was a little bit of a surprise. Please explain that.
For sure. It was a surprise for me as well. We used to have an ivory market here. The Obama administration shuttered that on a national level. However, there are a lot of Asian American communities here. There's a lot of wildlife product users. The cultural values that people have in China are brought over here, and that is the predominant driver of demand here.
Let's take a caller. Tom is with us in Brookfield. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question as to how many qualifies to be on the extinction list, because the demand that it takes to make a $7 billion whole field of illegal sales out there doesn't seem like it's very practical or profitable to be out in the bush hunting one animal at a time. If they have farms, I don't see the issue with having a farm. What do we do with buffalo and cows? We have a farm, we keep breeding them, and we can use them. We can eat them. We can use them however we feel. Just wondering how much farming there is versus hunting, if you guys even
know
that true number.
Totally. That's such a good question. And it's also a perennial debate between Southern African countries who do want to sustainably use wildlife. People in South Africa, for example, would like to harvest rhino horn. It can be trimmed just like fingernails and sold. However, in Vietnamese and Chinese communities, oftentimes they value wild animals specifically. They don't want some docile farmed animal, because the thought of something living in the wild imbues it with power, strength, purity. It's to the point now that some rhino horn users in Vietnam are asking for quote unquote wet horns. They want a horn that comes off an animal with flesh still attached to prove that it actually wasn't from a farmed animal.
Tom, thanks for your question. 800-642-1234, the number to call to join our discussion. Humans have driven species to extinction or very close to it many times in the past. Did we learn nothing from these experiences?
Yeah, unfortunately, humans just seem perennially short-sighted when it comes to respecting other creatures we share the planet with and the finality of extinction. That's not to say, however, that there are very many people working as hard as they possibly can to prevent these extinctions.
And it is part of the problem that we don't understand the significance when a species goes extinct. It's something, it's some animal we've never heard of. What's the difference if there are no more of them? What does it really cost us when we lose a species?
It's a great question. It is a problem if we don't even know something exists before it disappears. A pangolin is a great example. Many people here have never heard of them, even as they are being driven toward extinction. I am personally a person who believes that wildlife and biodiversity has an intrinsic right to be here, just like we do. However, from a human point of view, we can also make some strong arguments. If you think of ecosystems, you can think of a Jenga tower, for example. These are systems, they're webs that depend on interactions between different organisms. If you remove enough of those blocks, eventually the tower will collapse. And we depend on ecosystems for all kinds of services, from water. I'm here in New York and my water comes from the Catskill Mountains, to pollination of crops, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about people who are working to turn things around and save these vulnerable species. Tell us about organizations working to save animals. Let's start, for example, with pangolins.
Oh, that's a great question. It is not all doom and gloom. There are people working very hard and making significant headway against this illegal trade. One of my favorite pangolin organizations is a tiny grassroots group in Vietnam called Save Vietnam's Wildlife. It's run by a Vietnamese guy named Thai Nguyen, who's just absolutely passionate about saving his country's natural heritage. They are the only qualified sanctuary for pangolins in Vietnam. So whenever pangolins are confiscated, Save Vietnam hits the road, sometimes drives overnight to rescue those animals, brings them back to their rehabilitation station, gets them healthy again, makes sure they're disease-free, and then releases them back into the wild.
As of 2016, pangolins also have the highest protections under international law. Commercial trade of all eight species is banned. Do you think that's helped?
It's helped in the sense that it makes it much easier for law enforcement. So before that 2016 legislation was passed, Asian pangolins were banned, African pangolins were not. So if you get a big bag of scales, how do you know which species it came from? Now, if law enforcement intercepts something pangolin related, they know no matter what, no questions asked, it's illegal.
Let's take Terry. Let's take Terry's call. Terry, good morning. We're just about out of time, so please be succinct.
Okay. I wonder what the status of the shark fin poaching is coming. That's it.
Sure. Thanks, Terry. Yes, shark fin is a very big deal in China. It's often served at weddings and banquets. There has been headway made in anti-demand campaigns. Yao Ming, the famous basketball player over there, is the poster boy for saying stop buying shark fin. It is declining in Hong Kong. However, it is not solved.
All right. Thanks for the call, Terry. Let's take Ian in Milwaukee next. Ian, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So this past weekend, I actually just went to the Milwaukee Zoo, and I was kind of skeptical at first because, you know, I kind of get bummed out. But my girlfriend reminded me, you know, zoos have a pretty heavy focus on conservation. And it reminded me of a report I did when I was back in school. They used drones and, like, a team of scientists in sub-Saharan Africa to deter poaching. And it was, like, such an effective method, like, almost, like, deterred 100%. And I was wondering what other methods of technology are being used to deter things like poaching.
Okay, Ian, I'm really sorry to tell you this, but actually the drone headlines were way overblown. If you go to my website, rachelnewer.com, I have a supplementary chapter that I had to cut from the book because I wrote too much that'll tell you all about drones. And it was just a really big PR campaign that went wild. It's unfortunately a lot harder to stop them in the field, but drones can be a super effective method for counting animals, for example, in the field. So technology is a tool that can help us win this battle, but ultimately it's going to be won by the people on the ground who are dedicated to stopping it.
You've witnessed a lot of dark things in your work. What has that been like for you, and how do you keep on doing it?
Definitely it's the people like Ty Nguyen, who I mentioned earlier, that keep me going and inspire me. This is really depressing stuff, but it isn't all doom and gloom. There are stories of hope.
Share one of those as we go. What's one of the things that makes you hopeful about this situation?
There's a park in Chad called Zakuma, and in less than 10 years, the elephant population fell from 4,000 animals to 400. They were just being hammered by these poachers coming in on horseback from Sudan. Everyone wrote this park off as finished. Those elephants were going to die. However, a really effective conservation organization called African Parks came in and just completely overhauled the management and the way they do anti-poaching. Now the poaching has stopped. The elephant population is once again growing. It's just an amazing story of hope. If Chad can do it, we can all do it.
Okay, that's a great place to end. Rachel, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Love Newer, freelance science journalist who covers the environment and wildlife, is the author of Poached: Inside the Dark World of Wildlife Trafficking. I'm John Munson. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.